Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
Who says we still love each other?
Absolutely.
Go ahead, finish your thought. I'm sorry.
Johnny always butts in first. So it's always
to keep you from butting in first.
Oh, is he? Good morning.
Well, you know what's
good
so
morning,
beautiful
everyone.
You think we were married?
That you would think. But that's
oh,
what's going to keep you guys together.
Hezzy, did we tell you and our lovely listening audience that the other day Johnny said to me, so when's our wedding anniversary? And I thought about it and I said, 2 weeks ago.
That's good. Well, you know, that's the beauty of it. You could celebrate now.
Well,
we did.
Every is a
good
celebration with
oh,
Johnny.
Oh, listener.
Oh, my goodness. How are you today, Hezzy?
Thank God, okay. I think this is the most sane thing I'm going to do all day today. Listening to you.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, I'm scared now.
It's all right. It's
good
part
Lord
of the course.
All right, well, here we go. We're talking this about the 2022 Jeep Grand Cherokee Overland 4x4, which was a delight. And very, very nostalgic for me because I long ago and for many years owned a Jeep Grand Cherokee. And the thing that really stands out for me especially is how little there is in common with the forefather of the current Jeep Grand Cherokee. This is by far, well, you know, of course, over 20 years, all these new innovations that we've seen across the board in every single new model and make car has taken us onto a much higher plane. In fact, many, many levels above what I was driving, you know, that long ago. But the thing is that it's the what struck me most, and I wrote about this in Johnny's in my review for the Yonkers Tribune, is the power of this car. And Johnny, I think that you should speak about that engine because it is the one comment I made, and it's true, is it purrs. It purrs like a lion. I mean, not like your domestic house cat. It purrs, but it is a forcible car. Johnny?
Well, first of all, Laurie's talking about the changes in the Jeep over the years and stuff. And, of course, there was a period of time when Jeeps didn't even look like Jeeps. I mean, not really. Mm. And sort of softened that, kind of redone some things and given, in my opinion anyway, have given Jeep a look again. And it's more of, in my opinion again, it's sort of the European styling look, but I like it. I like it a lot. It is very smooth, very aerodynamic. It's just a really attractive vehicle. I do want to talk about the engine. I'll talk about that for just a minute, and then I want to go back to something else. But I'm always talking about cars being underpowered. This one, not underpowered. It had the 5.7-liter V8 Hemi engine with start and stop. But, I mean, 5.7-liter V8 Hemi in this, which is not the biggest of the Jeeps by any means, but in this this Jeep Cherokee. And responsive, oh, my gosh, it was great. You know, you're coming up to, like, here we have the circles, or roundabouts are called, but the circle, and you can ease in. You don't have to worry. There's no hesitation. You need to go around something, you step down on it, I guarantee you, you go around it. It's just really, really well done. The looks of it, back to the looks of it and that kind of thing, it's so different from what the original one, whenever, which is why I started the article, was whenever you think of Jeep, you know, Jeep, the only thing, the first thing that comes to your mind anyway, is the old Willys Jeep from the war, from World War II. And that's what, you know, I think that's the vision that people have. And from there, your mind moves into the newer looks and all of those kinds of things. But this Jeep was, you know, so far removed from, as Lori said, so far removed from those Jeeps of long ago. They're not even, they're basically on the same family tree. That's about all. But this one had the Napa, for example, Napa leather seats. And our Overland, our Jeep Grand Cherokee Overland, was not the highest level model in the Cherokee line. There are 7 different models in the Cherokee line,
including a third row seat model, which I think is phenomenal. Mm.
Except, as I said in the article, I was talking to a guy who had bought one in 2018, I think it was 2018, and he said they'd had three row seats, third row, and he found out they weren't practical. He didn't use them. He felt like he paid more than he should have because
he
got those.
Did he have 12 grandchildren?
Honey, our 12 grandchildren do not show up at
because
the same time anywhere.
Because we don't have a three-row seat Jeep Grand
that
Cherokee Overland 4x4.
That is not the reason they don't show up.
They do too show up in mass. Go ahead, Donnie.
We had 2 at Christmas, and we saw one about a year ago. But other than that,
no, that's not true. Then we've got our little girls. Anyway, we can discuss this later over a cup of coffee.
Mm, yeah,
but Johnny is right. So, you know, it resonates of the earlier Grand Cherokees. Obviously, it does. But this has got so much.
Oh, I loved it. And again, this was the like 5. Of the 7 models, this was the 5th one, and the Laredo, which is the beginning level Jeep Grand Cherokee, is $38,000. $38,000 for a really nice, comfortable, 4-door, good looking,
with all the safety,
responsive, blah blah blah, all that $38,000. When you get to and the high end, which is the Grand Cherokee Summit Reserve, Summit, highest reserve, not many of them, is $65,000. It's not cheap, don't misunderstand, but it's still a lot of vehicle.
And it has everything on it.
Ours, which was the Overland, Grand Cherokee Overland, had all of these things. Lori can tell about that, but ours came in the driveway at $68,000.
So here's what you do. When you're stressed out, here's what you do. You get into your 2022 Jeep Grand Cherokee Overland, and you go somewhere quiet. You know, maybe there's a quiet, you know, little wood area or a park or something like that. You know, where there's nobody around. You're all alone, and then you gently put back your seat. And you program it to one of 4 different massage programs in your driver's seat or front passenger seat. So you program your massage, and then you turn on whatever your favorite station is on the Macintosh sound system, surround sound system.
And take a nap.
And you've just saved yourself $100 for a massage therapist to work on you because you're getting it done right there in your car, surrounded by the music that you love. So that was unbelievable.
This is only the 2nd or 3rd car that I remember that we had that had the massage feature in it, and it's for the driver and for the passenger.
And in 3, you could get a soft, medium, or hard massages in 4 different waterfall. I forgot what the other 3 were. I mean, it was quite incredible. But the thing was, we have had cars in the past where they did have massage seats, but none as effective as this. This was really, you could feel it. It was, you know, just amazing. But that's not the best thing about this car. The best thing about this car is you can anywhere. When you're driving on the highway, it is automatically going to go down to a highway level because this car raises
up and down. Making it more aerodynamic.
Right, more aerodynamic, exactly. Because this car goes up and down depending on your ground clearance.
And you have control over that. You can literally raise the car. The whole car goes up. If you're going off-road in rocks and things of that nature and you want to protect the underside of the vehicle. You can literally raise it up. We actually raised it up, then stopped the car and opened the doors.
We had to slide out.
And Lori fell out.
Yeah, it was,
it was higher than
not a pretty sight. But it'll go 4, 5, 6 inches. And that's exactly what, so this is not only a powerful car on the road, you could take this vehicle probably anywhere short of the Grimpen Meyer, Sherlock Holmes, Hound of the Baskervilles, where they all sink forevermore in the Grimpen Meyer.
Well, and it also explains, because when you also think of Jeep, you think of 4x1, and you think of off-road. You really do. And so these Jeeps, all of the Cherokee line, and especially our Overland line, is equipped to go off-road. That's why you have that big engine. That big engine helps you maneuver when you are off-road, rocks, mud, whatever. When you need power in four-wheel drive to move the vehicle, you have it. And I just think that that's I think they've done a good job with that kind of thing. It's called, by the way, it's called Quadra Lift Air Suspension. And it's designed.
It really is remarkable.
Yeah, to move the car up and down, and you can set it so it's automatic. And so when you get out on the highway and you're doing 70, the car lowers itself because it's more aerodynamic. You can set it it'll actually adjust when you go off-road, but you also can raise it up higher. You actually have the control right at your right hand next to the gear shift.
And so let's, okay, so gas consumption, you say. I mean, you know, obviously you're
just. Yes, that's what I say, gas consumption.
Gas consumption, you say. Well, here's the, it's the same gas consumption I got on my car 20 years ago, 26 Highway, 19 City.
Which is pretty doggone good for
like
an engine that big.
That big? Yeah, unbelievable.
That's good.
And, I mean, I know that gas is now up to like $4 or $5 a gallon in California, and what's going on in the world, that we probably, we probably be able to get any. But the fact is, and walking is good for you folks. Just don't set out like from New York to Chicago by foot.
says two people who sit on their butt most of the day in front of the computer.
Not really. Just,
yeah, it's true.
Mostly. But in any case, the other thing that... So the gas consumption for this car is phenomenal. The smooth ride.
Oh, yeah. Excellent.
And as I said, it purrs like a lot, but not like, I've got to be clear about this. It doesn't purr like, you know, a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. You hear it there as you're powering up, but then it's total quiet cabin noise. I mean, it's...
Yeah, when you're accelerating, you get in track, you hear this room. You really do hear that room. And then as soon as it's up to speed, it's quiet again. It's just...
It's a very confidential feeling. You feel comforted by it.
Yeah, very good.
Years ago, I also had a Toyota Land Cruiser, and that was the original Land Cruiser where it was a steel body with no insulation and no suspension. Mm-hmm. Not the one
bounced
they have
along
today.
The road. Yeah. I remember those.
And I remember, when you got out, you had to go out and you had to, you know, lock in your hubs on your four-wheel drive. And and if you hit a rock, God forbid, you usually, you know, ended up hitting the top of your head on the top of the car. But the point is that when I got in a tough spot with that, I would be frightened a little bit because, you know, the vehicle would, you know, be on a angle. It would be difficult to try to get the wheels from stopping to spin, you know, and you'd be in a bad place. Honestly, I don't think that this, and I'm not comparing the two, needless to say, but honestly, if I was in a tight spot with this Grand Cherokee, I would not be afraid because it's just, it is everything in the construction and the thing of this vehicle has been a troubleshoot thing. They know what it can do and how much it can do. And as long as you get to know your car and what
it can do.
You know, we've driven European cars where we always have mentioned that in order to drive it, you've got to go to college to get a degree. Not so with this. Everything's where it belongs. But the point is, it offers so much. There is so much to know that it behooves you to learn about what the capabilities of this really great vehicle is. And yes, would I love to have one for myself? Yes, but the one I want is the new Jeep Wagoneer. But that's in six figures. Mm. It's a little bit past my pay grade right now. But that's the vehicle I would call my dream car.
Well, I want to say two things. One, you know, you mature as you get older. Hopefully you mature. I'm not sure about me sometimes.
No,
but you
don't.
But most people,
as they
get older. But I remember when I was in my 20s, I had a K5 Blazer, and it was exactly like Lori talked about. You got out and locked in the hubs when you needed to go in four-wheel drive. And, you know, that was the manly thing. You know, you drove a manly truck, you got out and locked in the hubs. But as you get older, you do have a different – well, the other thing was in the operational design of those four-wheel drive vehicles, you didn't always – well, the early ones, you didn't always trust when you could push the button and it would go into four-wheel drive. There was some getting – there were some things they went through until that became a feature that you could really depend on. Well – now look at the Jeep today. Jeep today, it's actually, you can program it, push the button, and it knows whether it should be in two-wheel drive or four-wheel drive. Do I trust that? Absolutely. Whereas I didn't when I had, you know, in the early Blazer stages when they were changing over. But you do. You trust, because of the newest technology on vehicles today, you trust that the car knows when it should be in four-wheel drive. Just like, and I'll tell you some things that reinforce that, it has automatic windshield wipers. You set it on automatic, and they come on if the windshield gets wet. You don't have to remember to turn them on. It's the same with lights. You set your lights on automatic. You have daytime running lights on at night. It has high beam, low beam control so that you don't have to worry about whether you're on high beam or low, putting your lights on low beam on oncoming car. It does all of those kinds of, lets you focus on driving. That's very important. Then you add these creature comforts, not just the massage. The fact that they're leather seats, they're heated. Now, I'm talking about front and front passenger and drivers are heated and air conditioned. The second rows of seats are heated. There is four quad climate control, which means you can control the sort of the warmth and everything in the front and the back. It has memory for the driver, and it has memory for the passenger. Lori used to always, you know, not complain, but she would talk about, you know, the driver gets the 12-way 12-way electronic seat control, but the passenger's was manual. Not on this one. This one, not only do you have the 12-way rolling it electronically, but you can also then set it. For the driver can set it to his or her setup, and it becomes one. You just program it for number one. When you get in, you push number one, and it goes to your seat settings. Or if you're the passenger, you can also set your seat to the dimensions and the height and all the things that you want, and then set that so that it is always in that, or you can draw it up, which you don't get that on a lot of vehicles. So, I mean, there's a lot, even though the car was $68,000, there's a lot of things in this Jeep that are, we consider luxury items, luxury add-on kinds of things, but the basic Jeep that can go off-road and big rocks and up and down and still gets good gas mileage and do all that the Jeep can do, that's the base. And then you get these luxury items on top of it. And it's just whoever put this kind of thing together, I think, had a good – and I always talk about this. They had a good idea of the American market. Is this something that you would probably buy in England? England is known for driving, what's the one they drive over there all the time? What is it, honey?
Land Rover.
Yeah, Land Rovers, which is the Land Rovers kind of sets up higher and does, and it's got a name. It's had a name for years. And that's what you see them driving in the country. Would the Jeep work over there? You darn right it would. Absolutely it would work over there. And I can see a lot of good uses for the Jeep over there. Not in town, but certainly out in the country.
Now we're going to switch gears a little. Pardon the pun.
Okay, switch gears.
And, Johnny, I want you to talk about the Jeep and White Christmas, because what I'd like to do is then read a portion of our review that we have in the Yonkers Tribune this week about an early Jeep and somebody who owned one. So would you talk about the connection with Holly Christmas and the Jeep.
Well, the old Willie's Jeep was in a lot of the cartoons that came out around about World War II, and of course in all of the movies that dealt with World War II. And then along comes, which Lori and I were talking about this, we watched White Christmas again, don't laugh at us, but we watched White Christmas again just, a week or so ago. And it's just one of those movies that I enjoy. I love it at Christmas, but I also love it any time of the year because there's a real good message in it. But in White Christmas, the opening, they're on the near the front, and the general comes up in a Willie's Jeep. Okay, and so you see it come and go, and it's in a couple of scenes. Then, toward the end of in the middle of the movie, Bing Crosby comes driving into the inn in a Jeep where he's been to the post office. And then later, you see the general driving into the train station in the Jeep, and there are all these Willie Jeeps. But you'll remember that after the war, and I know this because I'm old enough to remember back that far, there were a lot of Willie's Jeeps that were around at that time. They were decommissioned, sold, whatever, and people had them, and they were great on farms and mountain cabins, and that's what you did. You took the Jeep because you could get there when you didn't have a very good road. And so that was all of those kinds of things.
So with your permission, Hezzy, if you don't mind, I would like to read this. It's not long. Is that all right with you, Hezzy?
Absolutely. Are you kidding? I love that movie.
Here we go. Okay, well, this is actually what I want to write about, a Willie's Jeep that was driven in World War II. And so here, and as I said in the column, this is under our category of life, because Driving Me Crazy is about cars and life.
This is a true story.
So I'm reading. Here we go. I want to tell you the story of a man who spent the war in Europe traveling up and down the front lines in a Willie's Jeep. Though tall in personality, he was short in height, and when the Japs bombed Pearl Harbor, he was first in line to enlist. He was rejected because he was so short, but he knew people who knew people, and word got to the right person who gave the command down the line to let the guy in. Not only did he order this man to be accepted into the military as a private first class, but he gave him his assignment. With two other privates, he would course the front line in Europe, often in the line of fire, and entertain the troops, make them smile, make them laugh, because this guy could sing, and the other two could play the trumpet and guitar. We'd put on a show, he recollected. Maybe it was 2 a.m, maybe it was 4. But we'd have a cup of Joe, share some stories, a few jokes, and laugh. Then they'd go off to battle, and when it was over, we'd go after them and bring back the ones that got hurt and the ones who didn't make it. Well, we helped give them a good burial and speak some words to God. Then we'd move to the next gig in our Willie's Jeep and do it all over again. The next gig meant the next battleground, and this courageous soldier, at the risk of his life, put on a show again and again, again and again, and sang and danced, and the boys laughed. And for a little while, they weren't scared, till they'd go off to fight, knowing they might not come back, and too many didn't. I won an Academy Award, a Golden Globe, an Emmy, and I got 2 stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, my friend told me one evening when we were dining together. I got them all. But the only one that mattered was the medal General Patton pinned on my chest. You can see my friend on cable TV all the time still. He is in the Guinness Book of World Records as the actor who played in the most motion pictures in history. He was proud of his career. But the thing he was proud of most was being an American and the Bronze Star for courage that General George S. Patton indeed pinned on his chest. His name was Mickey Rooney, and he drove a Jeep. And that's my story.
That's unbelievable.
He was a wonderful man, and I was very blessed to know him in his final years. And when he told me that story, we were together dining, and he spoke with such passion and love for America and it was a thrilling thing to see the man who constantly put on a show with Judy Garland in the Andy Hardy movies and entertained America and the world for so many years. But he drove a Willys Jeep, and so that's how I want to kind of bring our broadcast to a close. Johnny, we've got a few minutes. Do you want to add anything more about this vehicle that you're going to get me for my birthday?
Oh, yeah, that's going to happen.
I'll let you get it in red, Johnny.
Yeah, thank you so much, Laura. You're so good to me. No, it's really, we covered most of the high points of the Jeep. It's and also, I hope you guys do, listeners, I hope you do look at the Yonkers Tribune. I've given the connection to the website. You can find out so much about the they have a beautiful layout for their website. You can look at every model. You can look at all of the colors. You can look at, there's videos that you can really see a lot. And then if you're interested at all, certainly go and drive one. You will not be disappointed. I don't care which model you pick. You will not be disappointed if you're interested in Jeep and driving one of these. It's like I said, it's come such a long way, and it still has its roots, its ability to go off-road and through things. It has the power, and it has the four-wheel drive capability, and it has so many improvements from the old one that it's really cool.
Let's go
ask
you one question, though.
Sure.
Since there are about seven different models, how does one, if they've never been introduced to a Jeep, how does one define themselves? You know, I think you really have to know who you are and what you need the car for, don't you? Because
well,
it's
that's
such a wide gamut.
Well, I think it's one thing. You've decided that you need something like this for whatever the reason is, where you live, what you do, whatever. So
yes.
First of all, you've decided. And then you would do something. You know, Americans are, I think a lot of them are like me. You would go to the Internet and you would look at each of the models and see what it's like, what features it has. You would you would look at it from the standpoint of, I would, what can I afford?
And also, this is a lifestyle decision. You know,
right.
You need the metallic, you know, paint. Maybe not.
Yeah, it's part of your budget.
You know,
it is. It's part of the budget. What am I looking for?
And how are you going to use this vehicle? You know.
And then, once you've done that, you actually go to a Jeep dealer and you see what they have. You look at them.
Speak to your dealer and find out what the options are.
Right.
You
set in one. Drive one.
You know, Johnny, we often say, who's going to buy this car? Everybody's going to buy this car. You can drive this into the city. This is a suburban car. This is a family car. This is a car for a couple. It's a car for one person who has dog
crates.
I'd love
one.
Yeah, I would too.
I'd love one.
This is the one, I'm telling you. And the reason why it's the one to me again is because I've been driving Jeeps actually for 40 years. And I've owned a Grand Cherokee, and I know that, you know, like my grandpa Bogart used to say, buy American or bye-bye America. And in this day and age, especially today when the world is blowing up, you know, we don't know what's going to happen in the future. But I do know that if we pull from our history and our past and the things that have stood by us, Jeep stood by me for many years in many snowstorms, in many, you know, good times and a whole bunch of bad ones. And so when you pick out a car, don't forget there's brand loyalty involved. And for me, that's a very strong point.
Mm-hmm.
But it may be something that doesn't matter to you or doesn't play into your life, like Johnny just said. So, again, you're right, Johnny. You've got to go and figure out what it is. And
well, I'll tell you this, having driven those Jeeps in the last several years, I have a place in Montana where I send people to go bird hunting. Pheasant hunting, duck hunting, grouse hunting, that kind of thing. Montana. And Montana is a great, beautiful, wonderful state. But when you fly into Montana and get out of the plane, you need a vehicle to get you to the camps, get you to the place where you're going to be hunting. I'd get a Jeep. Do you know why?
Mm-hmm.
Not every road is paved. You know, not every bridge is, you know, is the best. And you want something you can count on to get you there and get you back.
Well, that's us for this week, Johnny. We've gone through this pretty quick. And Hezzy, we hope you have a good week.
We've gone through it pretty quick. We took 30 minutes. It always takes 30 minutes.
Doesn't time fly?
when you're having fun. Yeah.
When you're having such a good Jesse, I hope that the rest of your day is just as jolly as our half hour we spend with you Thursday is
I can't ask for more. I can't ask for more.
Neither can
like
we.
Cadillac next week.
Yeah,
Cadillac.
All right.
CX-5, I think it is. Yeah, next week.
Vroom, vroom.
Vroom,
okay.
Vroom.
Right. Vroom, vroom.
All right,
all
my friend.
Best,
everybody
have
a safe
week.
Thank
you, Lori.
Thank
you, John.
And everybody stay calm. We'll get through these hard times.
All right.
Okay, take
bye-bye.
Care.
Bye-bye.
Beautiful. Bye. Thank you so much. Well, it doesn't get better than Lori and John, John and Lori, Wiles, W-I-L-E-S, the Driving Me Crazy duo. They don't seem to be that crazy, do they? Well, because they're not. Well, go on and see what else is really happening around the world. Excuse me. And there's much to really look into. The question is, how did Germany help blaze Putin's path into the Ukraine? And Berlin evidently gave the Russian president the benefit of the doubt until it was too late. Well, this is written by Matthew Karnitsing, and from Berlin, and can play this for you so you could hear it. Bear with me a moment.
How Germany helped blaze Putin's path into Ukraine. Berlin gave the Russian president the benefit of the doubt until it was too late. Berlin, as Moscow waged war in Georgia in the fall of 2008, German political and business elites gathered in Russia's palatial embassy in the country's capital for a lavish ball featuring of caviar, champagne and song. Russia had no fear in Berlin, one visitor recounted at the time. Russia is among friends. For Germany, the party never stopped. From the Georgian invasion to the annexation of Crimea, the downing of MH17 and the poisoning of Alexei Navalny, Germany has always found a way to forgive its friend to the east. A vast then chief executive, Egert Bochel, told the enthusiastic partygoers in 2008, peace can't be achieved through exclusion. The sentiment, Germany's unofficial Russian policy ever since, helped blaze Vladimir Putin's path into Ukraine, precipitating what many fear could be the collapse of Europe's post-Cold War security architecture. After Putin signed decrees declaring the breakaway regions of Donetsk and Luhansk independent of Ukraine and dispatched more troops there, Germany announced it wouldn't grant the Nord Stream 2 pipeline an operating license, but it was too little, too late. There are many fathers of the disaster unfolding in Ukraine. The United States refused for years to believe that Putin was as dangerous as he had turned out to be. The United Kingdom was more interested in attracting oligarchs wealth than in asking where it came from. But make no mistake, no country has done more to downplay and forgive Russia's transgressions than Germany. In popular mythology, that loyalty, like much else in modern Germany, is tangled up in its war guilt. If that were really the reason, though, Germany would owe an even greater debt to Ukraine and Belarus, countries that lost even more of their people in the war at the hands of the Germans, but who barely even feature in the country's collective remembrance culture. The truth is, Germans like to do business with Russia. As the Basque CEO noted at the ball in 2008, energy-rich Russia and technology-rich Germany are a good match. In addition to former Chancellor Gerhard Schröder, the affair attracted a broad swath of German elite, from football legend Franz Beckenbauer to state leaders to the chief executive of Porsche. Why let a little incursion or two rain on the parade? German defense contractors certainly haven't seen much reason to. For Putin, the big lesson from Georgia was that Russia's military was not as capable as he thought, so he set about modernizing it with, you guessed it, Germany's help. One particularly controversial project involved the sale of combat simulation systems for 100 million euros. Under pressure from allies, the German government eventually cancelled the deal, after 95% of the gear had been delivered. Even after Putin annexed Crimea and triggered the war in East Ukraine, Berlin refused to join the US in sanctioning Moscow, agreeing only to do after nearly 300 innocents were killed in the downing of MH17. Thereafter, Germany continued to give Putin the benefit of the doubt. Despite repeated reminders, whether Russia's role in Syria's destruction or the murder of a Chechen rebel leader in broad daylight in central Berlin, that he couldn't be trusted. weekend's decision this week to shred the so-called Minsk protocols, blueprints for ending the war in eastern Ukraine negotiated in large part by Germany, should later rest claims that he ever took Berlin's calls for dialogue, repeated like a mantra for years by former Chancellor Angela Merkel and her foreign minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier, who has since become president, very seriously. He was just playing for time. With oil prices high, Russia's coffers full and his military at the height of its capability, Putin is perfectly poised to invade Ukraine and realize his larger aim of ensuring the country doesn't drift further into the Western fold. Many Germans, however, see another culprit behind the Ukraine crisis, NATO. The myth that Washington promised Russia not to expand NATO eastward is considered received wisdom in many quarters of Germany. That's due in large part to the fact that the public is regularly told so on German public television. As part of the false balance German media tend to create when it comes to Russia, members of the left, a party born of the former East Germany's Communist Party, are often invited to news programs and talk shows about Ukraine. Never mind that the party won less than 5% at the last German election. NATO has expanded, not Russia, Sevin Gagelin, a leading member of the left, told a primetime audience last week. Sarah Wagenknecht, one of the left's most prominent members, followed a few days later on a popular Sunday program, accusing America of seeking to conjure up an invasion with aggressive rhetoric. While it might be easy for the discerning viewer to dismiss such claims as absurd, their constant repetition to an audience of millions has helped Russia drive a wedge into German public opinion, one that Putin has used to complete Nord Stream 2 and sow doubt about the country's alliance with the U.S. More than half of Germans don't want Ukraine to join NATO anytime soon, for example. And as recently as last month, two-thirds of Germans supported putting Nord Stream 2 into operation. One of the people most responsible for creating that wedge is Sigmar Gabriel, former leader of the Social Democrats who also served as both economy and foreign minister in Merkel's cabinet. I supported Nord Stream because I believed in the notion that economic projects carry a peace dividend, Gabriel told German radio in an interview on Wednesday. The question for me and Merkel is whether we were too optimistic. Putin would appear to have settled that question once and for all. Whether Germany will abandon its magnanimous stance towards Russia is another question. On Tuesday, about 600 people gathered in front of the Russian embassy in Berlin to protest the Kremlin's latest invasion of Ukraine. Neither Gabriel, who attended the ball in 2008, nor any of the other party guests, for that matter, were anywhere to be seen.
Yep, that's the story. So this is very interesting as well. This comes from France. Macron says that France will show no weakness, quote-unquote, on Russia sanctions on the military and economic level as well as the field of energy. We will be without weakness, the French president had said. So France will respond with no weakness to Russia's act of war in Ukraine, French President Emmanuel Macron said on Thursday in a solemn speech addressed to the French people. Giving a pre-recorded address in front of Ukrainian, European, and French flags, Macron said that, quote, sanctions toward Russia will be on the level of the aggressions it is itself guilty of. On the military and economic level, as well as the field of energy, we will be without weakness, he added. Russian President Vladimir Putin, quote, has decided to carry out the gravest attack to peace and stability in our Europe for decades, Macron had said. Today's events are a, quote, turning point in the history of Europe and our country, end quote, the French president had added, quote, they will have long-lasting, deep consequences on our lives. In these troubled hours, where ghosts of the past are reborn and where manipulations will be numerous, let's not yield anything from our unity, end quote. Continuing, quote, we're going to take decisions during this afternoon's G7, during the European Council that will take place this evening in Brussels, and the NATO summit, which will take place in the hours to come, Macron had said. So unbelievable but this is what's going on, and this is written by Jules Darminin, and we'll see, though, where things are going. Now, also today, we hear that Ukraine is pleading with NATO and European Union for arms equipment in the face of Russian attack. Kyiv, which is the way they pronounce it in Ukrainian as opposed to Kiev, which is Russian. So Kyiv set out a list of urgent needs in a documentary seen by Politico. So this is by David M. Helsenhorn and Lily Beyer. As the European Union and NATO offered thoughts and prayers while Russian forces closed in on Kyiv, Ukraine pleaded with Western allies for weapons and equipment, handing diplomats a detailed list of requests, according to documents seen by Politico. Hours after Russia launched a full-scale attack on Ukraine on Thursday, Kyiv issued concrete requests for help. In a list shared with NATO, the Ukrainian authorities outlined needs ranging from tourniquets and body armor to machine guns and ammunition. The country's immediate needs, quote unquote, include portable anti-aircraft missile systems and missiles for portable anti-tank missile systems, as well as bulletproof helmets and combat armored vehicles, according to the list. The Ukrainian government also needs large amounts of bandaging material and millions of thermal blankets, one of the documents noted. Quote, Ukraine is firmly defending Europe, end quote. Ukrainian Defense Minister Oleksiy Ryzhnikov wrote in a letter dated Thursday and addressed to European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. The minister pointed to Russia's intense shelling of Ukrainian positions as well as missile and bombing attacks against military installations and infrastructure throughout the country. Quote, at this time, Ukraine needs maximum practical assistance in the form of defensive and offensive weapons, logistics, communications, and personal protection items, he wrote in a letter seen by Politico. Well, Ukrainian forces, quote, are in a critical need, end quote, of anti-tank weapons, anti-air defense missile systems, ammunition, radars, and intelligence systems, the minister told Borrell. In a detailed list sent to the European Union, Kyiv asked European government to take steps to disrupt Russia's ability to wage war. The Ukrainian authorities is for Europe to provide Kyiv with air defense and anti-missile systems and anti-ship systems. Ukraine also urged Europe to terminate software licenses for military and civilian equipment in Russia and Belarus and asked European countries to use their capabilities to block Russia's satellite navigation system and jam signals in the region. Brussels should, quote, consider all possible options which are at the disposal of the European Union and its member states in order to immediately close all systems of communication, according to the list of requests. Ukraine also called for much tougher economic measures against Russia, including a trade embargo and seizure of sanctioned individuals' foreign real estate. Europe should also be prepared to use its civil protection mechanism to help meet humanitarian needs in Ukraine, the Ukrainian government also said. Now let's look at what we already know about Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And so bear with me a moment. Military assault launched by Russian President Vladimir Putin strikes multiple targets across the country. This is by James Randerson. Russian President Vladimir Putin launched a massive military assault on Thursday morning on Ukraine with strikes involving missiles, warplanes, and tanks hitting targets across the country. Here's what we know so far. Just before 6 in the morning, Moscow time, Putin announced what amounted to a declaration of war on Ukraine. Quote, we have taken the decision to conduct a special military operation, end quote, he said, adding it was for the, quote, demilitarization and denazification of the country, end quote, a frequent Kremlin propaganda claim. Military operations began shortly afterward with Ukrainian authorities reporting airstrikes at military facilities in the cities of Kyiv, Kharkiv and Dnipro, as well as artillery fire on the border. Quote, the authorities in Kyiv reported a pincer movement attack on its troops from Belarus to the north, potentially attempting an encirclement of Kyiv and from Crimea to the south. Russia insisted it was destroying military bases and airfields, not civilian targets. There were also missile attacks on a naval base at Ochakiv on the Black Sea coast and a number of military airfields, as well as Kyiv's Boryspil International Airport. The United Kingdom's Defense Ministry said there had been, quote, more than 80 strikes on Ukrainian targets. Western leaders have promised a fresh round of punishing sanctions against Russia. European Union leaders will meet Thursday in Brussels, that's today, to discuss their response. Well, the response in quotes, Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky said, quote, Russia has embarked on a path of evil, but Ukraine is defending itself and won't give up its freedom, end quote. U.S. President Joe Biden condemned what he called, end quote, unprovoked and unjustified attack, end quote, by Russia, and said he would, quote, continue to provide support and assistance to Ukraine and the Ukrainian people, end quote. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said that Russia's leadership will pay, quote, a bitter price, end quote, for the attack. End quote, and it will become clear that Putin has made a serious mistake with this war, with his war. President Emmanuel Macron said that France would, quote, respond with no weakness, end quote, to Russia's act of war. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said that she had spoken to Zelensky and reassured him that we are working nonstop to provide as much support as possible, quote, adding that Russia will pay a heavy price, end quote. United Kingdom's Prime Minister Boris Johnson said, quote, our worst fears have now come true and all our warnings have proved tragically accurate, end quote. He accused Putin of attacking a friendly country, quote, without any provocation, without any credible excuse. So, unbelievable what's going on. Now, let's look at this. The soul of Ukraine hunkers down for war. Lviv, which is closer to Krakow than Kyiv, has been preparing for conflict for months. Joshua Pozana, Lviv, Ukraine. Early morning in the western Ukrainian city of Lviv and blaring sirens alerted people to the Russian bombardment taking place elsewhere in the country. Behind the scenes, however, the city's top official was preparing to, quote, completely rebuild our way of living, end quote. The city of cobbled streets with Habsburg charm is closer to Krakow than to Kyiv, around 80 kilometers from the border with Poland. The expectation and hope here is that fighting will be contained elsewhere. Kyiv is the heart of Ukraine, but Lviv is the soul. Lviv Mayor Andrei Sadovy told Politico in his office just hours before Russian bombing began in the early hours of Thursday. Reports that Lviv's airport had been hit were not true. A city hall official said, though queues had formed outside banks and pharmacies along the central Shevchenko Avenue on Thursday morning. While many shops were closed, the central railway station was packed by early afternoon as many tried to book a ticket out of Lviv, while many more arrived from cities in the east of Ukraine. Sadovy's immediate response to the outbreak of conflict was to close schools and ask people to stay at home. Quote, we are preparing ourselves for the worst case scenario, a cutoff of electricity completely, he had said on Wednesday afternoon. Around 200 diplomats had moved to Lviv from Kyiv over the last week as tensions increased, including staff from the United States, United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, the Netherlands, Israel, and Denmark. Some, including the highest-ranking U.S. diplomat in Ukraine, Charge d'Affaires Christina Kvin, have now left for Poland. This region has a long history, and you see that Putin doesn't want Lviv, said a woman who identified herself only as Kate and said she works with the veterans of the Donbas conflict. It's never been part of the Russian Empire. Still, Lvov and its 700,000 citizens are preparing to fight. We have to politically rebuild our way of living, learn how to shoot, and learn medical skills, Sadovy, the city mayor, told Politico. And Russia will never be a peaceful neighbor. We must be like lions, end quote. He said the authorities started preparing late last year for making sure the water system functions without electricity in case power lines are disrupted. Local governments have been stockpiling fuel, hospital equipment, and blood supplies with enough to last 3 months, he said. A defense recruitment office opened in early February, and people aged 18 to 57 with military experience were asked on Wednesday. Lvov's police tested loudspeaker public announcement system in case of a sudden loss of internet, television, and radio signal. Threats have been rumbling on for weeks, with locals reporting that schools and shopping malls have been subject to bomb threats while cyber attacks have disrupted banking and communication systems. This week, Israeli diplomats had been scheduled to visit local hospitals to see how they could help make the health system more resilient, while Sadovy said more diesel generators were needed for backup power. Hundreds of municipal employees have been told to go through live fire weapons training, if not to prepare them for conflict, then to put them at ease. Quote, if you spend 2 hours at a shooting range training, then you feel better prepared, said Sadovy. Even if the fighting doesn't come to Lvov, the city will still be affected by conflict in the east. During fighting in 2014, Lvov saw 10,000 people arrive from the regions annexed by Russia and the separatists it backs in the eastern regions of Luhansk and Donetsk. This time around, Sadovy said the city is prepared to host up to 200,000 refugees. The region around Lvov can offer a home to 1 million. Amid all the uncertainty, Lvov's residents are considering their options. I don't know what we should do. It feels like we have no power, said Nazari Basarab, a 24-year-old electrical engineer living and working in Lvov. Quote, the main thing is, if war is coming, is to have time to prepare. We have had time, end quote. Now, let's just see what they've said from the United Kingdom. Boris Johnson promises a massive package of economic sanctions on Russia. The United Kingdom Prime Minister tells Ukraine, we are with you. Kingdom Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Thursday promised a massive package, quote-unquote, of economic sanctions that will hobble, quote-unquote, the Russian economy as he condemns Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. In a televised address on Thursday, Johnson said that Russian President Vladimir Putin's regime will be condemned to pariah status for unleashing a, quote, tidal wave of violence against Ukraine, end quote. He did not give any specifics about the new sanctions package against Moscow, though they are expected to be unveiled in a statement to the House of Commons around 5 o'clock local time. Russia has attacked a friendly country without any provocation or without any credible excuse, Johnson had said. I say to the Ukrainians in this moment of agony, we are with you. We are praying for you and your families, and we are on your side, end quote. Johnson said the United Kingdom government will now consider what further assistance it can provide to Ukraine amid calls from some of his own ministers of parliament to send aerial support. He insisted Western allies must also collectively cease the dependence of Russian oil and gas that for too long has put Putin his grip on Western politics. Describing Russia's invasion as a hideous and barbaric venture of Vladimir Putin, Johnson said the West will work with Ukraine, quote, for however long it takes to ensure that the sovereignty and independence of Ukraine is restored, end quote. For all his bombs and tanks and missiles, I don't believe the Russian dictator will ever subdue the national feeling of the Ukrainians and their passionate belief that their country should be free, he said. Now, 1 second. 1 second. And this is an opinion by Ulrich Speck. Putin Unchained. Europe must turn Russia's war against Ukraine into a failure. The Russian leader has shown he considers nothing off limits. He must be contained. Ulrich Speck is the editor of Morgenlage Außenpolitik, a daily briefing on German foreign policy. Out of Berlin, we hear from him with this week's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has abandoned the modus operandi that has defined his acts of aggression for more than 20 years. From his incursion in Georgia in 2008 and Ukraine in 2014 and 2015 to his intervention in Syria in 2015, the former KGB operative has always pursued his military objectives and activities either in the gray zone of plausible deniability or with legal pretext, such as being officially invited by the government. Not anymore. As the tanks roll in and helicopters fly overhead, Putin has made it clear he no longer cares about the semblance of legitimacy or about his global image, at least not in the West. He has already priced the cost of being called a war criminal by figures like Rolf Mützenich, the leader of Germany's Social Democratic Party's parliamentary group. Similarly, the suspension of the Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline is no longer a major. Putin has made his choice. He has put territorial revisionism, his dream of rebuilding a powerful empire, ahead of international legitimacy and of the Russian economy. This is going to change his relationship with the West. As long as Putin covered up his actions, many in the West felt they could live with him. When the Russian leader used violence, it wasn't easy enough to look the other way. And even when his action became too visible and or outrageous, there might have been public condemnation or the occasional sanction. But still, the hope of turning Putin into a partner prevailed. There was always the hope that if enough effort was made, or was being made, Putin would be brought in from the cold into the cozy postmodern world. Quote, today, it's clear that this strategy has crashed. Putin is determined to force his world, his reality, shaped by nostalgia, grievance, and the vision of a renewal of a great Russian empire onto Europe, using the only dimension of power he commands, which is military power. After a period in which some Western observers allowed themselves to hope he had been brought into the fold, he has resorted to open warfare, starting an open war of aggression. His earlier quiescence has been revealed for what it really was, war by other means. In the past 7 years, it seems he believed he could achieve his goal, control over Ukraine, for a much cheaper price. Russian-controlled separatists in the East failed to gain him decisive influence in Kyiv. Instead, Ukraine consolidated as an independent sovereign state. His open aggression comes after a last-minute attempt to use the threat of war, the military encirclement of Ukraine, to force the country into surrender and the West into becoming an accomplice in dismantling its statehood. The assault on Ukraine is a brutal wake-up call. This is Putin Unchained. He has crossed a major line, leaving European capitals with the question, who's next? Nothing seems to be off limits anymore. If Putin is ready for a high-risk operations against Ukraine, ignoring costs to Russia's global reputation and to its economy, he may as well be ready for other high-risk operations for the West. What the Russian leader wants is clear. He laid it out in his demands to the United States and NATO, the revision of the peace order that has emerged after the Cold War in Europe, namely in the territories of the former Soviet Union, potentially in the countries of the former Warsaw Pact, and even beyond. This is why Finnish President Sauli Niinistö has argued that Russia's acts target Ukraine, but at the same time, they are an attack on the entire European security order. Let me repeat that. That is why Finnish President Sauli Niinistö has argued that Russia's acts
target Ukraine, but at the same time, they are an attack on the entire European security order. And that's why Putin's aggression must be met with a firm response. Russia's Achilles heel is its economic dependency on the West. Targeting that with swift sanctions, serious sanctions, has therefore become an urgent priority. This will require sacrifices, especially from European countries with close economic or energy ties to Russia. But the economic price that Europe needs to pay now is far cheaper than what it will have to pay later if an imperialist-minded Russia, drunk on its victory over Ukraine, doesn't stop there. It's vital for Europe to frustrate Putin's imperialist designs to turn his war against Ukraine into a failure. Now, other issues that come into play. Bear with me a moment. One second. Okay. This is an opinion, inside an opinion on politics and policy. And this speaks to one very, very pertinent issue, and that's Putin's nuclear option. New deployments risk undoing years of non-proliferation progress. But Beatrice Feen is a Nobel Peace Prize laureate and executive director of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN. The end of the Cold War led to a miraculous moment in nuclear disarmament. As the Soviet Union collapsed, persistent diplomatic maneuvering led to the removal of Soviet strategic nuclear weapons stationed in Belarus, Ukraine, and Kazakhstan, as well as tactical nuclear weapons from all Soviet republics. But 30 years later, those gains are now threatened to be reversed, heightening the nuclear threat to its greatest level since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. Ever since Russian President Vladimir Putin recognized the Donetsk and Luhansk regions in the Donbass as independent states in violation of the United Nations Charter and international law, on Monday, the conflict's looming nuclear backdrop has been making its way to the forefront, providing a timely and frightening reminder of the importance of moving quickly to limit the risk of irreversible catastrophe. That Putin was joined by Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko to watch the Russian military carry out a nuclear weapons exercise earlier this week was no coincidence. The two men have been moving toward an agreement that could redraw Europe's nuclear map. Putin has increasingly grown more belligerent on the nuclear weapons front, showing a disregard for international law and promoting dangerous escalation. Lukashenko, meanwhile, is turning words into action with a referendum that would change the constitution of Belarus to allow nuclear weapons on Belarusian territory as of Sunday. Lukashenko has also said Belarus would be open to hosting Russian nuclear weapons, and Russian officials have declared their intention to do just that if NATO deploys weapons further east or if Ukraine joins the alliance. Russia and Belarus are not alone in their aggressive and irresponsible posture either. The United States continues to exploit a questionable reading of the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, the NPT, that prevents states from possessing nuclear weapons but allows them to host those weapons. Five European states currently host approximately 100 U.S. nuclear weapons: Belgium, the Netherlands, Germany, Italy, and Turkey, even though public opinion strongly opposes these deployments. Suddenly, the unthinkable, quote-unquote, is unfolding before our eyes. This is how a regional conflict turned into a global nightmare. A good summation of nuclear weapons conventional wisdom for decades has been, quote, trust that cooler heads will prevail. In the past, leaders of European countries shrugged their shoulders as Nobel-winning organizations like the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, the International Committee of the Red Cross, and the United Nations warned about the catastrophic humanitarian consequences and increasing risks of nuclear weapons use. We are now seeing that it is not a gamble we should be taking with the fate of the world. To put this all in context, new deployments of nuclear weapons in Eastern Europe could station U.S. and Russian nuclear weapons closer than at any time in history. This would not be a second Cuban Missile Crisis, but a far more volatile situation. There is, fortunately, a clear path to de-escalation and disarmament. First, the international community must strongly condemn Russia's violation of international law and stand firmly behind Ukraine's right to sovereignty. Lukashenko must also change course and respect the will of the Belarusian people, who want their nation's non-nuclear status to remain codified in the Constitution. But these alone are not enough. All countries in Europe, from Russian allies like Belarus to U.S. allies in NATO, should sign the binding United Nations treaty called the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the TPNW, which entered into force last year, and commit to never be a part of using, possessing, or hosting weapons of mass destruction. Current crisis reminds us that states that develop nuclear weapons are not the only ones impacted by the current threat. There is no such thing as a limited nuclear war, and any use of nuclear weapons in Europe would draw in dozens of nations. There is no health care or emergency response capacity to deal with such consequences, not in any of the nuclear armed states nor any international organization. The treaty does, however, close loopholes in the NPT and empower non-nuclear weapon countries to take concrete action to promote disarmament and ensure their nations will never host these banned weapons. Hope and trust in a handful of bellicose leaders is not a concrete strategy to prevent this crisis from becoming a nuclear catastrophe. But this treaty could be. We urgently need diplomatic action based on international law that holds on to disarmament gains made at the close of the Cold War and expands on them. We need it now. Now, let's look at some other issues. Bear with me a moment. All right, bear with me a second here as we move on. One second here. One second. Okay. All right, one second. This is what I wanted to share with you first. Taiwan has warned that Chinese aircraft are in its air defense zone. Some Reuters. Taiwan's Air Force scrambled again on Thursday to warn away 9 Chinese aircraft that entered its air defense zone. Taiwan's defense ministry said on the same day that Russia invaded Ukraine, a crisis being watched closely in Taipei, the capital of Taiwan. Taiwan, which China claims as its own territory, has complained of regular such missions by the Chinese Air Force over the last 2 years, though the aircraft do not get close to Taiwan itself. The number of aircraft involved was well off the last large-scale incursion, where 39 Chinese aircraft on January 23rd, and since then, such flybys have been sporadic with far fewer aircraft. Now, the ministry said that the latest mission involved 8 Chinese J-16 fighters and 1 Y-8 reconnaissance aircraft, which flew over an area to the northeast of the Taiwan-controlled Pratas Islands at the top end of the South China Sea. Taiwanese fighters were sent up to warn the Chinese aircraft, and air defense missiles were deployed to, quote, monitor the activities, the ministry said, using standard wording for how Taiwan describes its response. Taiwan has been warily watching the Ukrainian crisis, nervous that China may try to take advantage to move on the island. While Taipei has not reported any unusual movements by Chinese forces, the government has increased its alert level. China has never renounced the use of force to bring Taiwan under its control and routinely condemns U.S. arms sales or other shows of support from Washington. speaking in Beijing earlier on Thursday when asked about the U.S., the new U.S. Indo-Pacific strategy. Chinese Defense Ministry spokesman Tan Kefai reiterated that Taiwan was a, quote, core issue, end quote, of China's, and it would tolerate no foreign interference. Quote, we urge the United States side to recognize the high sensitivity of the Taiwan issue, stop interfering in China's internal affairs, and stop playing with fire on the Taiwan issue, Tan had said. In the 12-page Indo-Pacific strategy overview issued earlier this month, the Biden administration vowed to commit more diplomatic and security resources to the region. On Taiwan, Washington would work with partners inside and outside the region to maintain peace and stability in the strait dividing the island from China, it said. Reporting on this by Ben Blanchard, editing by Raisa Kozolowski and Bernadette Baum, all part of the Thomson Reuters group. Oh, God. Now, let's just look at some other issues that you may find interesting. One second. Now, one second here. Where is it? Yeah, I think this might be it. No, not quite. Bear with me a second here. Sorry about the delay. All right. Okay, let's first look at this. one second here. This is a speech that launched war in Europe. Unfounded accusations of genocide, comparisons to the Nazis, and a chilling warning to Ukraine's allies. A closer look at Russian Vladimir Putin's address early on Thursday morning, in which he announced Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Let me just quickly see. It's only about, let's see if this is, one second.
Pluralt's Hyper Network is a multi-carrier redundant model for
Okay, let's see if this works.
When Vladimir Putin took to the Russian airwaves with a menacing tone.
I have decided to conduct a special military operation. It aims to protect people who have been bullied and subjected to genocide by the Kiev regime for 8 years.
Unfounded accusations of genocide used by the Russian president to justify a full-scale invasion. Putin accused Ukraine of going after pro-Russians in the separatist eastern regions and said Russia would target the Ukrainian army.
We will strive for demilitarization and denazification of Ukraine.
Even as Russian tanks rolled into Ukraine, the Russian army's supreme commander-in-chief claimed it wasn't an occupation.
We have no plans to occupy Ukraine. We do not plan to impose anything by force.
His tone, though, was unambiguous as he finished his declaration with a chilling warning to Ukraine's allies in the West not to interfere.
Whoever should try to stop us and further create threats for our country, for our people, should know that Russia's response will be immediate. Leading to such consequences that you have never faced in your history.
Some experts say it was a barely veiled threat that Russia is prepared to use its nuclear weapons.
Well, just so you heard that again, it's something a little bit different than what we had mentioned to you before. But it's definitely, that's exactly what was said. One second here. Let's look at this, because I think this is also really quite pertinent. Bear with me a moment here. Moldova, then Georgia, now Ukraine. How Russia built bridgeheads into post-Soviet space. Moscow's recognition of breakaway Ukrainian territories has prompted comparisons with past Russian operations aimed at countering Western influence and bolstering its strategic depth in the former Soviet bloc. After months of denying plans to invade Ukraine, President Vladimir Putin ordered Russian peacekeeping, quote-unquote, troops into the country's separatist territories, Donetsk and Luhansk, on Tuesday, recognizing the two eastern entities, which Russian-backed rebels seized and occupied in 2014 as republics independent of Kyiv. Now, despite the specificities of the Ukrainian crisis, analysts were quick to note that Putin's move fitted a recent pattern in Russian military operations aimed at cowing neighbors into submission and thwarting their westward aspirations, in the process halting any further eastward expansion of NATO. The Kremlin has long used so-called, quote, frozen conflicts, end quote, to extend its reach beyond Russian borders. For the past three decades, it has backed a pro-Russian regime in Moldova's breakaway region of Transnistria. In 2008, it launched a conventional invasion of Georgia in support of separatist governments in South Ossetia and Abkhazia, two provinces with large Russian-speaking populations. 6 years later, Russia seized Crimea from Ukraine and began supporting an insurgency of pro-Russian separatists in the Donbas. In each case, fears of a drift away from Russia's sphere of influence precipitated Moscow's actions, while the presence of ethnic Russian populations provided the Kremlin with a pretext to step in as the protector. The same logic was at play during Putin's rambling speech late on Monday, in which he claimed without evidence that Ukraine's Russian-speaking citizens were being subjected to genocide. Putin's latest brazen move follows months of seesawing tensions during which the Russian president amassed a formidable army along Ukraine's borders while keeping the world guessing. In the end, the timing of his move may well have been determined by another bizarre parallel with the Georgian conflict, this one fortuitous. In 2008, Russia's war with Georgia erupted at the start of the Beijing Summer Olympics, much to the chagrin of Chinese officials. To avoid upsetting China once more, Putin has this time waited until after the Winter Games closing ceremony was also in Beijing before striking again in Ukraine. Now, Putin's move signaled an eerie deja vu for Georgians, still reeling from their country's bruising defeat in the hands of Russia. It came as little surprise to Professor Emil Avdalyani of the European University in Tbilisi, that's in Georgia, and the Georgian think tank Geocase. In Georgia, many of us were expecting the recognition of Donbass's two separatist entities. It was obvious for the past year or so, Avdalyani had told Franz van Katz. Now, Moscow has been increasing its financing of the entities, providing Russian passports and clandestinely increasing its military presence. Putin's decision is a logical conclusion to the process. So Russia's move followed an established playbook, Avdalyani had added, the creating or fostering separatist movements in order to preclude a neighbor from drifting towards Western institutions. With their large ethnic minorities shuffled across borders before and during Soviet times, countries lining Russia's western rim have offered fertile terrain for conflicts to emerge and fester. According to Moscow's narrative, such conflicts are rooted in its rightful claim to a sphere of influence and its duty to protect ethnic Russians from foreign aggression. Quote, Russia perceives itself as entitled to a historical sphere of influence, the so-called near abroad, and doesn't allow anyone else to infringe upon it, said Niccolo Fasola, an expert in Russian military strategy at the University of Birmingham in Great Britain. Russia is always anxious about foreign penetration, not only in terms of military involvement and political engagement, but also in cultural terms, Fasola advised France Enquête, he noted to the so-called color revolution that brought pro-Western governments to power in Georgia, that was in 2003, Ukraine 2004, and which the Kremlin perceived as, quote, instruments of the West to drive those countries away from Russia, end quote. That rationale underpins Russia's continued presence in Moldova's breakaway province of Transnistria, where attempts to impose the Romanian language at the start of the 1990s were fiercely resisted by the region's mainly Russian-speaking population. The same concept, protecting ethnic Russians, would later give Putin a blueprint to justify interventions in Georgia and Ukraine. While Russia has stopped short of recognizing Transnistria's independence, it, quote, has weakened Moldovan sovereignty and frozen its Western integration for the past 25 years, Eric J. Grossman writes in the U.S. Army War College Quarterly. Quote, this uncertainty has served to trap Moldova in a geopolitical gray zone between East and West and forced it to act as a vehicle for Russian corruption and money laundering. Both Georgia and Ukraine are now in danger of being sucked into the same geopolitical gray zone, cornered in between their hopes of one day joining NATO military alliance and the knowledge that Russia won't let them go. As for their respective separatist entities recognized only by Russia, their fate is entirely dependent on Moscow. And those entities could not survive by themselves. But their fragility is actually a plus for the Russian protective perspective because it ties them closer to Russia, said Fazola. They would be unable to survive without Moscow's help, in turn justifying Russia's continued presence on the ground. In recognizing the two republics, quote-unquote, of the Donbas, Moscow has stuck meticulously to its tried and tested playbook, reproducing word for word the treaties of friendship and mutual assistance it had previously signed with Georgia's breakaway provinces of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Whether those entities can prosper is a minor concern for Russia when compared with the overall strategic picture, said Fazola. Moscow will provide financial and logistical help, but at the end of the day, there are no more than tools for the achievement of Russia's strategic goals, he explained. It's all about using them as bridgeheads into the post-Soviet space, instruments to control the situation on the ground. Just how much control Russia can exert remains to be seen, with critics noting that Putin's actions have hardened anti-Russian sentiment in Ukraine and Georgia. As Georgia's President Salome Zurabishvili recently said, her country understands, quote, very well what the people of Ukraine feel today. This is solidarity from a country that has already suffered and is still suffering from occupation, end quote. Russia may have attained its short-term objectives, but it has, quote, lost prestige and soft power, end quote, said Avdaliani. Few in Ukraine or Georgia would think about turning to Russia geopolitically. I think in the longer run, Russia has squandered the advantages it held even after the collapse of the Soviet Union. For the Kremlin strategists, however, resentment against Moscow is a price worth paying to ensure NATO's expansion is halted in its tracks. It is true that Russia's course of action since 2014 has angered the Ukrainian public and legitimized Kyiv's anti-Russian posture, said Fazola, but the same government in Kyiv is well aware of the fact that Russia can decide or at least strongly influence its political decisions. However, much anti-Russian they might be, they have to take into account Moscow's positions and actions. From a Western perspective, Russia's aggressive strategy has come at a clear cost for Moscow in the shape of steep sanctions, which are set to get steeper, and sharply deteriorated relations with an outraged and compact Western front. On the other hand, if we base our assessment on Moscow's stated goals, meaning the maintenance of Russian control or at least influence over those specific regions, then we could say that the Russian strategy has been successful, Fazola cautioned. Of course, one could counter that neither Of course, one could counter that neither Georgia nor Ukraine have given up on joining NATO, but de facto, NATO membership is no longer a viable option. However much Georgia and Ukraine want to join NATO, they simply cannot. The same reasoning applies to the West, Fazola added. On paper, Western powers decide who joins NATO, but in practice, they cannot ignore Russia. My goodness. So, just have to see where all this goes, but it doesn't look good. And there will be more to pay. And who knows if Poland is not next. I wouldn't be surprised. And nobody will stop them. Nobody. Absolutely outrageous. One second. Well, some good news here from the United States. U.S. weekly jobless claims resume a downward trend. Fourth quarter gross domestic product revised slightly up. Out of Washington, we hear that the number of Americans filing new claims for unemployment benefits fell slightly more than expected last week, indicating that the labor market recovery was gaining traction. The weekly jobless claims report from the Labor Department on Thursday also showed unemployment rolls shrinking to levels last seen in 1970, underscoring the tightening labor market conditions. There is an acute shortage of workers with a near record number of job openings, keeping layoffs minimal. Beyond weekly moves, we see the downtrend in filings persisting as virus-related disruptions continue to dissipate and businesses return to more normal operations, said Rubila Faruqi, the chief U.S. economist at High Frequency Economics in White Plains, New York. Overall, strong demands for labor and labor shortages suggest layoffs will remain low. Initial claims for state unemployment benefits decreased 17,000 to a seasonally adjusted 232,000 for the week ended February 19th. That almost revised the prior week's surge, which economists had blamed on week-to-week volatility in the data and the delayed impact of winter storms earlier in the month. Economists polled by Reuters had forecast 235,000 applications for the latest week. Unadjusted claims tumbled 24,824 to 214,873 last week, led by a sharp decline in Missouri. And there were also significant decreases in filings in New York, Ohio, Tennessee, Florida, and New Jersey that offset a large increase in Michigan. With 10.9 million job openings at the end of December, claims are likely to fall back below 200,000 in the coming week. They were last below this level in early December. Many Federal Reserve officials view labor market conditions as being already at or very close to maximum employment. U.S. stocks opened lower after Russia launched an all-out invasion of Ukraine. The dollar rallied against a basket of currencies, while U.S. Treasury yields fell as investors sought a safe haven. Claims have dropped from a record high of 6.149 million in early April of 2020. The number of people receiving benefits after an initial week of aid dropped 112,000 to 1.476 million during the week ended February 12. And that was the lowest level for these so-called continuing claims since March 14 of 1970. The continuing claims data covered the period during which the government surveyed households for February's unemployment rate. Continuing claims declined between the January and February survey weeks, implying an improvement in the unemployment rate, which was at 4.0% last month. Now, fewer people on unemployment rolls also suggest that some out-of-work people are returning to the labor force, which could help to ease the worker shortage. Now, the workforce is about 1 million people smaller than before the pandemic. The tightening labor market conditions are boosting wage growth, which is contributing to high inflation. Rising wages and better job security should, however, help to underpin consumer spending and sustain the economic expansion, even as the Fed starts raising interest rates to tamp down inflation and government money to households and businesses dries up. Now, the U.S. Central Bank is expected to start raising rates in March, with economists anticipating as many as 7 hikes this year. A separate report from the Commerce Department on Thursday confirmed that economic growth accelerated in the fourth quarter as the drag from the resurgence in COVID-19 infections over the summer, driven by Delta variant, eased. Now, gross domestic product increased at a 7.0% annualized rate last quarter. The government said in its second gross domestic product estimate that was slightly up from the previously reported 6.9% pace. Economy grew at a 2.3% pace in the third quarter. And the upward revision for fourth quarter gross domestic product growth reflected more business spending on residential structures and investments in home building than initially thought. There were also modern upgrades to state and local government spending. The economic momentum, however, appeared to have faded by December amid a strong headwind from coronavirus infections fueled by the Omicron variant, but activity has since picked up as the winter wave of infections subsided. Retail sales surged in January, and business activity rebounded in February. Data showed this month, and that has created an upside risk of gross domestic product growth estimates for the first quarter, which are mostly below a 2.0% rate. Now, the United States is reporting an average of 80,131 new COVID-19 infections a day, sharply down from the more than 700,000 in mid-January, according to a Reuters analysis of official data. And so that's the story, reporting by Lucia Mutikani, editing by Chizu Nomiyama and Andrea Ricci from the Thomson Reuters group. Okay, so that's where we are today. We're going to end our broadcast today. I think we've covered a tremendous amount of help with Thomson Reuters and Franz Van Katz and so on. So there we are. Let's hope for the best. It doesn't look good. I think we're going to go into a major head spin downward. It's not a healthy thing. Okay, so let me just leave these sites. Bear with me a moment. We'll wish you a goodbye. And we'll speak to you tomorrow, probably for only a half hour's time. I think for only a half hour. I'm not sure. It may be a half hour, and that's about it, because I have a medical appointment that was unexpected, and so I've got to go. Anyway, so take care and be well. Goodbye.